Fred Film Radio, Locarno Film Festival, Switzerland.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti from the 70th Locarno Festival. Today I'm in company of director Todd Haynes, who's here to receive the Pardo d'Onore Manor and to talk about his future projects and the latest Wonderstruck that was the opening film of the Cannes Film Festival competition. What has changed for you in the last years in the way you approach a new film or, after Carol, a new script?
Well, you know, it's relatively new for me to open the door of stuff that's out there in the world that I haven't generated myself. For many years, that's really what I did. I sort of developed and wrote my own material, and my agent was, you know, would tell people, no, he doesn't read scripts. Stay away. It was a great experience and process to do so. It took a lot of time to do so, to generate, research, produce, write, finance your own work one after the next. And it meant that I was extremely single-minded, one thing at a time. And I would see other directors, you know, balancing different projects in different states of development. And it's only recently that that was something I was like, that would be interesting. I would like to do that. I also wouldn't mind working more, having more projects come into my life more quickly. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it was since Mildred Pierce, which was also a different process. I did originate that and adapted it from a novel with a friend. But since Mildred, I have directed two films that were not my scripts.
Have you fallen out of love for writing scripts?
I don't know if I've fallen out of love with it, but it's been a new part of the creative process, you know. And I get involved with the scripts that I take on, like Carol or Wonderstruck, and work with the writers and make it into something that feels like it's my work. What's funny is even when it is your script, there's a funny way in which it becomes something other once you embark upon it. It's an assignment that you give yourself, and then you kind of need to work yourself through it and discard. And once you're shooting, the script is history. And even while you're filming the script, what's happening in production means that the script is just a blueprint for what you're doing with the camera and with your actors and with your locations. Once you're done shooting, it's over and you're in the editing process. And you have to be able to keep discarding and not hanging on to the imprint and the expectations and the assumptions that you have conjured at each stage. I think it's the only way to really see what you have in front of you, and to also let it become what it is at a certain point. You can do everything you can to manage that process, but ultimately it is what is in front of you.
What did it hit you about Wonderstruck? Was it the fact that it could be a kid's movie, something that you...
It was that. It really was that initially. I mean, I mean, it was obviously, this script was so film fluent. It had such a rich cinematic language, series of references, historical material. Brian's adaptation of his book was intensely intercut on the page, so you felt the editorial rhythm of what it could be. And so it felt already like it had moved into a different medium, from a book into something else, and that was enticing and stimulating from a cinematic perspective. I wanted to feel like I could create something with as much love and attention to detail and history and character as I've given to my adult dramas, but something that kids could be able to experience. You know, I went back and I saw movies that had meant a lot to me when I was a kid. And I found that they were mature films that weren't necessarily catering to a different audience. The movie Sounder, I hadn't seen since I was 12, the age of the kids in Wonderstruck. And I thought, oh, it's going to be kind of a manipulative. Do you guys know that movie Sounder?
Okay.
It's a beautiful film from 1972 with Cicely Tyson and nominated for Best Picture. It was very well received at the time. Martin Ritt film. And I thought it was going to be a kind of a tearjerker about a dog. The dog's name is Sounder. It's about a sharecropping family in 1930s America and the story of the boy going after the father once he gets imprisoned and trying to find him. And the movie is so sophisticated and so subtle. And I was astonished at how restrained it is and how mature it is. I don't think it was even marketed as a family film, but we all went as a family to the film, and it was it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And I was like, yeah, you can treat kids like anybody else and assume that they have a range of experiences and emotions and, you know, responses that can handle complexity.
What's the border and the balance between fiction and reality for you? There's a line between those two, especially in Bell Bell Mine and I'm Not There. And I was wondering, how are you working on this balance and being thin line in the Velvet Underground documentary?
You know, both of those films I tried in my two music-based dramas, I really tried to find a sort of formal and stylistic strategy to get to the core of what these specific artists were doing in their music. And, you know, and the first question you have to ask in tackling any subject, any historical subject, however interesting, is why should it be a film? Does it need to be a film? Is there a visual language that is suggested by, or a cultural kind of legacy that this person's work, you know, justifies in a medium that I consider a visual medium, and certainly a musical medium as well, but one that isn't always, you know, that maybe all great biographies are not necessarily made for the movies. And so in both those cases, I really tried to bring the unique characteristics of each subject. They're very different movies, so it's hard to generalize beyond, you know, about that. But a sense of the artificial and the theatrical to Velvet Goldmine, and a sense of creating a parallel kind of narrative that is all drawn from real events from the Bowie era and the Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, you know, love affair with Bowie and so forth, but have it be a fictional narrative, because they themselves were turning themselves into fictions and creating hybrids and fictional kind of icons out of their own creative drives as musicians. And with Dylan, who I just kept seeing as someone who was serially killing, you know, creating and killing off his various personas and his interest that he would get incredibly deeply engrossed in a particular moment and almost have to by necessity destroy it in order to have the freedom to move on to something else, and also the freedom to withstand the success and expectation and burden of his own fame that I think, you know, he always had to manage as someone who's fundamentally a creative being. You know, he has to create fresh air to create in each time, which necessitated a death of the prior era, you know. I don't know. The Velvet Underground, I think, is a new project. We just, you know, we haven't even put together a structure for the production itself, how it'll be financed. I've never done a documentary, per se. And to me, documentaries are written in the editing room. So it's about compiling information and interviews, but letting, and in this case, the images do need to tell the story. So it's also about finding what those images are for a band that is notoriously undocumented, for its influence. Given its influence, there's hardly any footage of the Velvet Underground performing. So we're going to have to find different ways of visualizing what that moment felt like and that time and place felt like. The thing is what's very relevant and unique to the Velvet Underground is how much it came out of avant-garde cinema and music. At least where John Cale was concerned, Andy Warhol's films were concerned, obviously. So many of the sort of cross-pollinating elements of that time were informed by the avant-garde. And if it lost, it's a lost time. It's a time that feels further and further and further away from our contemporary culture, and experimental cinema in general feels so remote. But it'll be great to get into all that stuff, have it all in front of us, and start to really see how it speaks and how it relates. And I think the form is going to come out of that. It needs to have that, I think, that fluency and that, or that, freedom of invention, and not have a set plan from the outset.
Before Moonlight, it was very hard to see a gay film awarded with an Oscar. There was the shock with Brokeback Mountain, and even Carol wasn't nominated, not even for Best Director. Do you think that something is finally changing in Hollywood?
I hope so. I don't know how much I want to, look to Oscars as a marker for the... I mean, we can talk about the world of the Oscars, but I'm not sure that it's a limited, domain that I think, kind of reflects back on itself perhaps more than it once did, and doesn't necessarily define where our culture is. And so it's kind of playing catch up to the culture all the time. It doesn't mean we don't look to those kinds of designators as placeholders in our progress as a culture, what's permissible, what's commendable, what's meaningful. But as we all know, the Oscars do not define what great movies are. There's way too many examples of films that have had no relevance to the Oscars whatsoever that are the true, The Velvet Underground is an example of a musical band that had so much influence but had almost no commercial visibility at the time. I mean, it had no commercial visibility at the time, but the way influences are marked is a whole different kind of narrative or history. So yes, it's one way of looking at a kind of progression of visibility. I don't have much more to say.
Did it bother you not to be nominated for Best Director for Carol?
Yeah, I thought we should have had a nomination for Best Director and Best, but mostly I hated, I think the process that directors and artists go through to go down that, campaign, which I know can help the marketing of a film. I mean, for me, my goal was to do all the work in promoting Carol as possible, to get people to go see the film on the screen as much as is possible, because that is a diminishing practice today. And it's a film, like all the films I make and the films that I respect, I want to see them on the screen before they go away, you know? So I would do everything Harvey said I should do for promoting Carol. It wasn't to win. And if he said we should do this for the Oscar campaign, I'd be like, okay, if it's going to draw attention to the movie to get people out there to go see the movie before it goes onto people's phones, I'll do it, you know?
Do you think there are certain type of films that you're supposed to do at different ages in life? Do you make Wonderstruck now and directing Poison at the beginnings, for example?
No, it's funny. The last time I saw Poison, it shocked me. And it had been years since I'd seen the movie. And it demonstrated to me a different side of myself, of my history, of our history as a culture, of a kind of radical, fierce, you know, almost terrorist, you know, approach to the language of movies. You know, I think we completely evolve and change as we mature and grow. And I don't have that same radical child who made that film is no longer who I am. But I also miss a queer culture that was not getting married and wanting to, I mean, I appreciate and I am fully supportive of all the legislative progress that gay people have made and trans people have made and the sense of having choices in our lives. But when you are fighting to be alive, let alone be accepted into at the table of, you know, normal, the status quo, you have a different kind of critique, and I think it sharpens your wits, and you are more weaponized to change the world and alter the world. And I don't know that that's sustainable through one's entire life. And you win victories. I mean, now people don't die of AIDS. That is a victory of such. There's so many people that I lost. That had they survived past a certain number of years would not have been the case. So we, you know, you look back at but we fought that fight and we had a victory. But I think you lose things along the way as well, you know. I think being excluded from the society teaches you things that you don't learn when you're included in the society. And you don't, and look, we have big questions about what is outside the society today. What is the counterculture? What is the critique? Where is the critique? Where is the activism? You know, and it's almost too easy to have the target be Donald Trump. It's disappointing and enraging. And yet it's essential to be focused on that conflict because it's so profound and in your face and extreme and verbose. But the nuance of discussions about representation and, you know, are no longer the things we are discussing. We have much more urgent matters that are extremely black and white, as they were during the AIDS crisis. They were black and white. They were survival issues, and now we have new ones to deal with, you know? So I
was talking to a kid in college who was coming out of his philosophy class, and he felt like, yes, I'm ready to take on the world. And I was like, yeah, that reminded me of myself. And that's what I want to hear, you know? It's something that needs to, and I think we get inspiration from our elders and from people who came before us, as I did.
Can you tell us something more about this Velvet Underground documentary project?
It wasn't something I sought out to do. This sort of came to me as an invitation. And I'm working on another project that's the focus of my creative work right now. But I definitely said I would love to do this project. But to me, it's about going back to that time and learning from it, as I did with Velvet Goldmine, and learning from that time. I mean, there was a reason why Velvet Goldmine is described as a lost moment, a time that is bracketed in that film as something already gone by a sort of fictionalized 1984. It already is gone, you know? And in a way, I think I felt the only way to tell that story is to not pretend that I could give it to you. It's something that's already gone that you have to find yourself. It's up to you to find your own Velvet Goldmine.
You worked with Julianne Moore in 4 films. Will you tell us more about her?
She's okay. yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I've worked with some extraordinary women. I've worked with some extraordinary men. I have a special history with Julianne. We feel in many ways like our careers were sort of emerged together in those early days in the 90s. And I've watched this extraordinary career continue to grow and multiply in what she's done on the screen. And it's hard to think of a living actor who understands that medium any better than Julie does. I am still astonished by what she does when we work together. I don't really understand how much she knows how to be present in front of the camera and hold back just enough, reveal just enough. Again, by the same token, I was astonished by this child, Millicent Simmons, who's never acted before in her life and who's deaf, and who again knew how to calibrate the level of expression for the lens in a way that, you know, conveys exactly what needs to be conveyed scene by scene. Julianne as well. She saw this kid and said, this girl has something innate, something you can't teach in her, you know? And the fact that they're playing the same person on two sides of the story is remarkable. But yeah, there were scenes that we shot with Julianne where I didn't know exactly what was happening in front of the camera until I saw the dailies, until we cut the scene. And then the wealth of emotion that she somehow is able to harness and then share. And again, I know she sets up a system for herself that both controls and protects a process of the unknown from happening. At the same time, she's so technically consistent from take to take, where you can intercut any take of the same line freely, and she's doing the same gestures. So there's something both intensely alive and intensely formally in control at the same time, which is really what the magic of film is. And it's still a mystery to me. It's really an amazing. I know she prepares for everything she does. We're both similar in that way. We sort of have to really bone up each time on whatever we're doing. But there's also something absolutely in the moment that happens with Julianne that is the mark of great film acting.
Thank you, Todd Danes, for being on Freffy Radio again for the second time after Carol. And this is Chiara Nicoletti from Locarno 70 for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.